It's a daily show today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An anonymous op-ed in The New York Times has veteran political watchers grasping for words.
I'm not that young, and I've been traveling the world for 3 decades, and nothing prepared me to cover such a political phenomenon ever.
This French journalist says that even before the op-ed, Trump had become his sole focus.
It's a show that comes from the White House and is a daily show. And again, I think it's a soap opera turning into a Greek tragedy.
Or maybe even a novel.
In the book, I explore the idea that people spend so much time managing Trump that ultimately they fail to manage the crisis, which spirals out of control.
Plus, we have lots of stories today that aren't about Trump, I promise, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It seems to be the only thing people are talking about today.
We are tracking a breaking story out of the U.S. The New York Times has just published an anonymous opinion piece describing a, quote, resistance.
President Trump, we are told, erupting after learning about the shocking op-ed that Savannah just read in part. Volcanic is how
it is our belief that a lot of folks must be dreading going to work in the White House this morning, because yesterday the New York Times published.
And I'll answer your other question directly, because I know someone will say, gosh, he didn't answer the question. It's not mine.
That last voice, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, saying he didn't write it. That explosive opinion piece in the New York Times asserts a deep lack of trust in the president, and that senior administration officials have even explored options for having Trump removed from office for being unfit. We're going to look at the story today, starting with this question: how much attention is this making in other parts of the world?
Oh, quite a lot of attention.
Philippe Gély covers Washington and the U.S. for one of France's biggest newspapers, Le Figaro.
Even if you are following every day, like I do, based in Washington, D.C., what's going on in the White House and spend a lot of time there, every time you see that obviously a high-ranking official is saying such things about the president of the United States, you really realize once again that this is such an unusual presidency, such an unusual president. I'm not that young, and I've been traveling the world for 3 decades, and nothing prepared me to cover such a political phenomenon ever.
Yeah, I can just hear in your voice, like you're searching for the words to describe this moment right. In this op-ed. This anonymous column came out just after the Watergate journalist Bob Woodward published his latest book, Fear, which also makes some pretty damning claims about the inner workings of the White House under Trump. Are the French media also covering the fear story as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all this is quite stunning. I mean, when you read that high-level cabinet officials stealed official papers from the desk of the president to avoid him signing and getting rid of an international trade deal. When you hear those people say that they discard his orders when they think they are irrational, well, that's not every day, right?
How are people in France responding to these stories? Or is there just a lot of Trump fatigue right now?
There is some Trump fatigue, but still, judging from the number of comments in the stories posted online, I mean, the story about the anonymous op-ed was ranked first most of the day in Le Figaro's website.
Yeah, so what are people saying?
Well, I think most people are stunned and flabbergasted by this show. I mean, this show that comes from the White House and is a daily show. And, you know, it's a soap opera, and it's turning into a Greek tragedy, I think.
Do you manage to write any articles for Le Figaro that aren't about Donald Trump?
That's a very good one. Very good question. I've been a correspondent here previously from 2003 to 2009 under Bush and covering the election of Obama. And I used to say that a correspondent in Washington, it's a three-third job. One-third is about American politics, the White House, the Congress, the Supreme Court. One third is about diplomacy, because everybody comes here, every head of state. And one third is about traveling and you know, human stories and society issues in the country. With Trump, it's at least 85% Trump.
Wow.
I mean, he sucks the oxygen. Even when you report on very concrete issues, immigration or the opioid crisis, there is always Trump in the background, at least, if not in the front.
Philippe Gély, chief U.S. correspondent for the French daily Le Figaro, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Not everyone in Europe was shocked by the anonymous op-ed. Rick Nowak is a reporter with the Washington Post. He's based in Berlin. I gather a little ho-hum in some parts of Europe. You looked at Germany and Denmark. What reaction did you see there, Rick?
Well, interestingly, there weren't too many reactions. A lot of countries or a lot of media outlets in those countries didn't really feature it very prominently. And in fact, one Danish commentator was wondering about the reasons for the absence of that story in European media. And he figured that there's just some kind of saturation with Trump news here in Europe, and that people now have long believed that there is chaos in the White House. And this revelation isn't actually that surprising.
Yeah, right. Stop the presses. We know there's chaos in the White House. I'm just curious, what were some of these media outlets in Germany and Denmark focused on instead?
Well, in Germany, media outlets were focusing on Turkey and the currency or a financial crisis there, or even on the possibility of diesel cars being banned in cities there. In France, I think, if I remember correctly, Le Figaro featured a story about 40-year-old people retiring. So this really wasn't topping the news agenda here in Europe today.
Yeah, we just spoke with a Figaro reporter. He failed to mention the retirement age.
Okay.
So those media that did focus on it, though, what were they saying?
They were saying that this essentially confirms something people have believed or gathered from other reporting for many months now, that there is a certain degree of chaos in the White House, that there's a split within the White House, and that some people within the White House don't really know what the other side is doing, too. And that has been in the news for 1.5 years now.
So for outlets that are commenting on the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, and for those outlets that have opted not to do anything on it, everybody's seeing that this is kind of how Trump operates.
Yes, and he's been operating like this since his inauguration. In Europe, there's always been a lot of skepticism, of course, of this presidency. Trump's approval ratings in Europe are very, very low, especially in Germany, where you had a very interesting poll coming out today, in fact, that said more people here are afraid of Trump than of terrorism or really any other threat they say this country could face. So there is almost a certain sense of hostility here. And really, that explains why this didn't really come as a surprise to many commentators here or people who have been observing what is happening inside the White House.
Yeah, so these narratives out of Washington are rattling people. What about leaders? I mean, how have leaders responded to this across Europe? And is it going to change how they work with the U.S.?
Well, you have seen some differences within Europe, how leaders have responded to things Trump has done in the past. And we really haven't seen that many public remarks today or public statements. I think that leaders weren't really pressed to comment on this. But what you have seen in the past is that, for instance, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been trying to be very careful when she's criticized President Trump because she's afraid of the response or the reaction in case she's more outspoken about it. You've seen other leaders that have been more confrontational, such as at times French President Macron. But you haven't really seen anything like that today.
Rick Nowak with The Washington Post speaking with us from Berlin. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
The anonymous author of the opinion piece in the New York Times states that there are adults in the room in the White House. The author says this to reassure Americans and goes on to say these adults are working to mitigate what Anonymous says are Donald Trump's half-baked, ill-informed, and occasionally reckless decisions. But can these adults stop a war? That's an issue that international relations specialists have been examining closely for some time. Jeffrey Lewis is a scholar at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He's also the author of a startling new novel titled The 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. Just to clarify again, that is a novel. And a lot of listeners, Jeff, are likely to have heard about the book. But for those who haven't, what's the premise?
Well, it's an epistolary novel, which means it pretends to be a government report set in 2023 that looks back on the nuclear war that unfolds between the United States and North Korea in 2020. So I'm hoping it stays in the fiction section.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on your own experience in arms control. As a scholar at the Defense Department, you are literally at arms control wonk on Twitter. So how realistic and plausible is the story in your novel? I mean, did you have to embellish for the purpose of entertainment?
Generally speaking, my approach was just to take real people and have them do the things they do, but just change the circumstances a bit and add some bad luck.
So in your book, in your novel, the president is Donald Trump in 2020. In your judgment, how reassured should Americans be that Anonymous and the other adults in the White House can prevent Donald Trump from, say, triggering a war?
Well, I'm quite skeptical of Anonymous and people like that. One of the themes I wanted to explore in the book is what happens when people think that they're doing the right thing, but what they're really doing is enabling the president. And I explore the idea that they spend so much time managing Trump that ultimately they fail to manage the crisis, which spirals out of control. So I'm not reassured at all. And in fact, I thought that Anonymous op-ed was a kind of display of all the things that I'm critical of.
Do you think there's anybody in the White House who could stop Trump from provoking a war?
Not if he wanted to. I don't think Trump wants a war, at least the way I treat him is a kind of a force of nature. He's more of a bull in a china shop than he is a strategic actor with some evil end in mind. But, you know, the reality is that the president has the unfettered sole authority to order the launch of U.S. nuclear weapons. And that's an order that would bypass the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It would go right to the National Military Command Center, right out to the launch units, and there would be no recalling it. So we have a system that is built for full presidential control, and now we're pondering whether we really want such a system.
So there's nobody or no thing that can stop the president from ordering a nuclear strike?
Not if that's what he wants to do, no.
What about short of a nuclear war? I mean, what power does the president have these days to order military action?
Well, you know, that's an area where he is going to need cooperation of other individuals. Of course, he's legally entitled to insist on anything he wants. But I think what we have seen is – you know, a sense that people tend to try to slow roll him administratively. That's something that actually I depict in the book. You know, there's a point at which the president does want to take certain actions with regard to North Korea. And the Secretary of Defense, who in the book, as in real life, is James Mattis, he turns the president around. But, you know, while at some level that's reassuring, that's not really doing the business of America. It's not really managing the problem. It's managing a person. Those aren't the same thing. And I think, you know, danger can slip into those cracks.
You've been in international relations for decades. Have you ever seen a situation either here or abroad where alleged senior officials say the chief executive is unfit for office?
I suppose I could scrape my brain and come up with a couple of examples. But I mean, this is really, truly strange. I mean, you know, historically, there are moments when Nixon's drinking was really out of control. And I think there were individuals in the Carter administration who simply didn't care for President Carter's policy preferences. Everyone thought he was fit. It's just they didn't agree. And I know at the end, I think some people had concerns about how good Ronald Reagan was on a day-to-day basis as he aged. But boy, those all seem like minor league examples compared to the current moment.
Jeffrey Lewis is the arms control wonk on Twitter. His new novel is the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. It is a novel. Jeffrey Lewis, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, will the auto industry win or lose under President Trump's plans for a new NAFTA? You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. The U.S. economy is in good shape for now. The latest unemployment numbers are out today, and they're encouraging, showing lows not seen since the 1960s. But there is that growing trade war with Canada, and a real chance that the U.S. and Canada will fail to agree on an updated NAFTA deal. President Trump is insisting on changes to NAFTA that he says will create more jobs, but many in Michigan's auto industry don't buy that. Either way, a revised agreement is likely to have a dramatic impact on the North American auto industry. The World's Jason Margolis reports from Detroit.
The General Motors factory in Detroit is so big that you could fit 71 football fields under its roof. It's so big that it actually spans two cities.
So we've actually entered into the city of Hamtramck. Once we cross through into the body shop, we're actually...
Robert Belega gives me a tour riding in a golf cart. We watch the frames of Chevys, Buicks, and Cadillacs slowly roll down assembly lines that weave back and forth through the sprawling factory.
So if you were to stretch our track out into one big long line, it's actually 16 miles of conveyor.
It takes a car about 3 days to navigate from start to finish. People and machines work side by side.
And as you can see up ahead, we got one of our autonomous vehicles that are actually transporting parts around the plant.
You heard that right. Driverless vehicles have already arrived on the factory floor. Now, NAFTA has been a hot-button issue for 25 years. Many argue that it's allowed American car companies like GM to compete in a hyper-competitive global market. Others say the trade deal bled jobs from the U.S. to Mexico. GM wouldn't comment on the ongoing NAFTA talks, but agreed to show me around their factory to see the complexity of 21st century supply chains. When the squeaky new car tires drive off the line in Detroit, most of us casually call them American-made Buicks or Cadillacs. But the car is really the sum of its parts.
If you look up at the front of the car there, we got that white piece of paper there. That's what we call a manifest. That manifest has every part that would be needed.
Willega says each manifest has more than 2,000 parts listed, parts from across the globe.
I actually think that number's low.
Julie Freem is the CEO of the Original Equipment Suppliers Association, a trade group that represents about 500 automotive suppliers in North America. She says that number, 2,000 parts in a car, is low because GM is getting some pre-assembled modules. When you factor in every little nut and bolt...
It's over 10,000 parts, well over 10,000 parts that go into a vehicle.
If the Trump administration gets its way with revised NAFTA, 40% of a car built in North America would need to come from a North American country, where workers earn about $16 an hour. In other words, from the U.S. or Canada. I asked Freem if this change would drive more work to the U.S.
I don't think it's that simple. As you increase the amount of content, yes, you will potentially, short-term, look at increasing the jobs, but it may also increase the cost.
Which gets passed along to you and me. The administration also wants North American-built vehicles to have more parts from Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, and for them to be made from more North American steel and aluminum. So let's say a Ford built in Mexico or a Buick made in Detroit doesn't meet those thresholds. Then the automakers would have to pay a small tax. Kristen Gicek with the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor says automakers would probably just pay it.
It is much cheaper to pay 2.5% than it is to invest in new plants, expand capacity, to do all the things you would need to do to jump through these hoops is, in many cases, more costly than paying 2.5%.
But all those small extra costs would add up quickly. Gicek estimates that some American brand name vehicles built in Mexico and Canada could cost $500 to $2,200 more. Add in President Trump's repeated threats of tariffs on imports on cars and car parts, and Gicek says the result could be more than a million fewer vehicles sold in the U.S. And again, vehicles filled with a lot of U.S.-made parts.
And that result would be about 200,000 fewer U.S. jobs.
If you try and force more manufacturing into the U.S., well, the U.S. needs to be ready with both raw materials and the workers. Julie Freem with the Parts Suppliers Association says they're already having difficulty finding enough tradespeople, technicians, and engineers to work in the U.S. as it is.
So the challenges of, I'll say, quote unquote, bringing jobs into the U.S., we don't have the people to do the jobs we have now. And so we need to think very carefully about the perhaps unintended consequences of what we're trying to do here.
Still, many say something needs to be done. The United Auto Workers put out a statement last week saying NAFTA has had a devastating impact on workers for 25 years, and they remain committed to reworking the trade agreement. But the statement also had a note of caution, saying, quote, as always, the devil is in the details. The UAW turned down my interview request, saying they don't comment on ongoing policy proposals, quote, until there is something concrete. And there are still a lot of unknowns about a renegotiated NAFTA. What would the final version say? Would Canada be part of a new pact? And would Congress give the necessary approval for any new deal? Kristen Jiecek says she's relieved that more than a year of uncertainty looks to be ending soon. But she says a new NAFTA doesn't fill her with optimism.
I've said it over and over again. It's sort of dodged a bullet situation, you know, that it could have been so much worse. This we can live with. This is not so bad. But I don't think any Main Street should be having a big parade for all the jobs that are coming home, because there's not a clear set of positives for any auto-producing region in the U.S.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Detroit.
This has been a violent week in Afghanistan. That is the side of the country we hear about all too often. But there's another Afghanistan. And next week here on The World, that's what we're going to take a look at and hear from people whose stories weave through the violence and trauma, but their stories are about more than bloodshed. Actually, an incident just yesterday in Afghanistan is a good case in point. The Islamic State said it carried out attacks in an area that's home to many members of the Hazara ethnic minority. Hazaras have often been targeted by Islamic State and the Taliban. In fact, that discrimination has led some Hazaras to change their appearance so they blend in. And that's why plastic surgery is becoming popular in Afghanistan.
And we removed here some fat and also some skin.
The World's Own Shirin Jafari meets a plastic surgeon who performs cosmetic surgery on Hazara women.
How many patients do you operate on every single month, Hazara patients?
At least 20 per month. We have operation in the upper room. If you want to see, we'll go, okay?
Shirin gets a tour from Kabul's celebrity plastic surgeon and speaks with the women choosing to change their looks. That's coming up next week. Untold Afghanistan starts Monday.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. You know the saying, time is money. It's true, especially when you run your own business. But running a successful business involves taxes, contracts, and a whole lot of fine print things that eat up too much of your time. Well, it's time to turn to LegalZoom. Over the last 17 years, more than a million Americans have used LegalZoom to help launch and run their businesses. Why? Because LegalZoom has a network of independent attorneys and tax professionals who can provide you with the advice and business resources you need to get through your daily grind of running your business. And the best part is, you don't have to worry about driving to anyone's office or being billed by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. So invest your time and money into growing your business and let LegalZoom help with the legal stuff. For special savings, be sure to visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. Doug Ford campaigned on a promise to throw out the new sex ed curriculum in Ontario schools. He's in, the curriculum's out. And some students can't understand why.
Nothing in the sex ed curriculum is telling kids to have sex. It's just making sure that they have the information to do all of those things safely.
Ontario rolls back sex ed. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A momentous decision today in India. The Supreme Court lifted the ban on gay sex.
It's a very welcome step. Most of us who've been tracking this space have been waiting for this to happen.
157 years. That's how long they've been waiting. You heard the voice there of lawyer Girish Mallya. Reporter Chavi Suchdev is in Mumbai. She says the court's ruling came sooner than expected.
We found out just yesterday that the verdict was coming out today. It was actually meant to go to court at the end of September. So surprise announcement. I think the whole country was sort of refreshing their screens or checking news announcements till 11 o'clock this morning. Nobody did anything. And then the celebrations have started. Social media is overwhelmed, television, talking heads. And then there are celebrations spontaneously happening everywhere. I went to a small one in Mumbai where about 150 people had come out on short notice on a working day to just hug each other, chant slogans, wave rainbow flags around. It was really, really fun.
So this was a unanimous ruling. Was that expected?
I don't think it was expected as much as hoped for. We were all surprised that all five justices agreed. Four of them wrote their own opinions as well. And some of it's really flowery. One of the justices wrote in his legal opinion, may I quote? It says, the human instinct to love was caged by constraining the physical manifestation of their sexuality. Gays and lesbians were made subordinate to the authority of a coercive state. And then he goes on to write how, you know, it's like from denial to freedom. And quite astonishing that they put so much thought into making this decision about equality, about personal freedom, about individuality.
So this is not the first time that India has tried to legalize gay sex. That was tried in 2009, but it was overruled. Why was that then?
The first time it was proposed to strike down Section 377, which criminalized gay sex, was actually 2001, and that was also struck down. It's been tried five different times, and each time the High Court seems to have hedged, and they've said it's a legislative problem. We can't change the laws. So it was quite amazing that they decided they could, after all, change the law.
Mm. Before today, Chavi, when gay sex was still criminalized, what impact did that have on the LGBTQ community in India?
So it made them very vulnerable to all kinds of things. I feel like all the gay people I knew were having sex behind closed doors, and most people tacitly agreed that what happens in the bedroom is their business. But if somebody has an axe to grind, they can threaten them because the very fact that they're practicing sex makes them a criminal. So just like how Al Capone was nabbed on charges of tax evasion, if you wanted to get somebody for something, you could charge them with breaking the law for practicing gay sex. And this was happening, whether it was from different mafias or even sometimes the cops.
So now this ruling, in recent years, there have also been the first gay pride parades across India. Would you say the attitude toward LGBTQ people has been more accepting?
It is happening more, and lots of smaller towns are having their first gay pride parades. I also today met somebody who came out after the ruling.
Oh, really?
And was living a closeted life, yeah, but felt that he could tell his parents because he didn't feel like a criminal anymore and nobody could do anything to him after this.
Yeah, that must have been an enormous weight off his shoulders.
I'm sure. I met a lot of people who were out and proud, and they were still jubilant. It was such a beautiful atmosphere at the celebration this evening.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev speaking with us from Mumbai. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
So a lot of celebration in India, but it can be hard to have these kinds of conversations about sex and gender identity, especially hard for kids. In some places, schools are helping out with sex education classes, like in Ontario, Canada. Back in 2015, the provincial government introduced a landmark sex ed curriculum for grades 1 through 8. The new curriculum was designed to be more inclusive of transgender and gay people. But when students start school this week in Ontario, they won't be taught that curriculum. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, sex ed has become deeply entangled with politics there, and it starts with one conservative politician with a familiar last name, Ford.
If you recognize Doug Ford's name, that might be because of his brother, Rob Ford, the former mayor of Toronto, who was famously caught on video smoking crack, yet refused to resign. That Ford passed away 2 years ago. This summer, when Doug Ford became Premier of Ontario, that's like governor of a state, he followed through on two campaign promises. One was to make a bottle of beer cost $1. That's something a premier can do in Canada, regulate the minimum price brewers can charge.
When I go across Ontario, all I heard everywhere I went was buck a beer, buck a beer, buck a beer. A simple thing like a buck a beer, it goes a long way.
Doug Ford's other promise was to roll back a new sex ed curriculum in public schools. That's also something a premier can do in Canada. And Ford did it a month after he took office, in July, a week or so into summer recess. So the reaction was delayed.
My friend called me and he was like, hey, no one's doing a protest. We should do a protest. And then I was like, okay, sure, that sounds great.
Rain Fisher-Kwan and I are talking in a coffee shop in Toronto.
Today's
her 17th birthday.
Thank you.
When Fisher-Kwan was 4, Canada became the 4th country in the world to legalize same-sex marriage. She was 12 when Ontario elected Kathleen Wynne, the first openly gay premier in Canadian history. Back then, Fisher-Kwan says her sex ed classes were dismal.
People, like, didn't know how many holes a girl had. Like, there were, like, it was really bad.
When Fisher-Kwan was 14, things changed. Premier Wynne updated the sex ed curriculum in public schools. Starting in first grade, the new Wynne curriculum covers topics like body parts. As kids get older, it branches into things like masturbation, consent, boundaries. There were also conversations about same-sex marriage, online bullying, gender identity, and sexting. Activists celebrated many of the changes as more inclusive.
It was actually useful stuff, and it was actually like stuff like, here's the law around when you can have sex. Like, here's the law about who you can have sex with. And that's really important, because when you're in grade 9, and I know a lot of parents don't want to believe this, but kids are having sex, or they're going to have sex very soon.
Some parents who objected to the Wynne curriculum kept their kids home in protest. Fisher-Kwan's dad teaches first grade, and half his students were out for the first few days. She thinks a lot of the objections were based on misconceptions.
Encouraging safety in every way isn't a dangerous thing. If you're telling a kid how to, like, cross the street safely, it's not, like, you're not telling them that they can cross the street whenever they want, or it's not encouraging them to get hit by a car. You're just telling them how to do it.
Things died down, and schools taught the Wynne sex ed curriculum until earlier this year. Premier Wynne's Liberal Party suffered the worst defeat of a governing party in Ontario history. Wynne resigned, leaving an opening for Doug Ford's election. He's with the Progressive Conservative Party. Ford rolled back the Wynne curriculum, and the protest Fisher-Kwan helped organize ended up being one of the first in response.
And I thought, like, 50 people were going to show up. I was like, this is going to be a failure. And it ended up just being this huge thing and this huge success. And we were, like, trending number one in Canada on Twitter, and it was really cool.
The event jump-started a movement that quickly got big, like teachers marching in the street big. People who disagree say those protesters are overreacting, like Matthew Wojciechowski of the Campaign Life Coalition.
All these organizations who are freaking out about this, I say, give it time. Doug Ford did not say he's repealing it, and we're never talking about the sex word. You know, he's not saying that. He's saying we repealed this radical sex ed curriculum, and we're hopefully going to create and implement, with parental consultation, a proper sex ed curriculum. It's not like we're going back to the dark ages and we're staying there.
The provincial government has released an interim curriculum. It doesn't include the words gay or transgender. And discussions about gender identity in the Wynne curriculum were problematic for Wojciechowski, who has 3 kids, the oldest starting first grade this week.
There's this push to almost change social and cultural norms about human sexuality. There is no consensus on this issue. And we've had parents call in saying, my child, my son came to me today after school crying, saying that he doesn't think he's a boy. Because at school, his teacher said, you can be a girl or a boy if you want. You can change your gender whenever you want to. And then he's wondering, but daddy, am I a boy or a girl? I don't know anymore. And then we're thinking, how dare these teachers, or how dare this program, confuse these children?
These topics should be left to parents, Wojciechowski says, because they're the best people to decide what's appropriate for their kids.
My teacher actually said that I can be sexually active without actually informing my parents, and that I have access to birth control.
Julia Bissonnette's a volunteer at the Campaign Life Coalition, and she's a student going into grade 12 at a public Catholic school. That's a thing in Canada. She had some sex ed classes she thought were way too explicit.
I think it has affected behavior, because before, nobody really was open about having sex with other people, but now I notice a lot more after that specific class that a lot of my peers have been bragging about having sex with this person or sexting this person. And I think it's opened the door to be more promiscuous.
A lot of other people have spoken out against the Wynne curriculum. Muslim voices have been prominently featured in media coverage of the ongoing debate, including Kuwaiti immigrant Faris Marish, who's with the Canadian Family Alliance. I had to reach him while he was driving.
It's actually sexualizing children, and it's inviting them. It's making it easy for them to engage
in sexual activity.
Marish decided against enrolling his daughter in public school for first grade because of the WIN sex ed curriculum. His wife is homeschooling her.
There are a lot of homeschooling groups that popped up in the city because of this, and students are doing well.
Although Doug Ford has been compared to Donald Trump and labeled anti-immigrant, Marish says Ford is actually a family values guy who understands the WIN curriculum is dangerous.
They're teaching our children, and they're creating safe spaces in schools to teach the children to explore their sexuality. They're corrupting our society.
In response to people like Faris Marish, Sidra Ahmad wrote an opinion piece in the Toronto Star.
I was concerned that there was this narrative being created that all Muslims are against the new sex ed curriculum.
Ahmad recounted how in elementary school, she was kept out of sex ed and sat for an hour in the library. Not being in the class meant she didn't learn some things, and Ahmad says that later made her vulnerable to abuse. She wrote about someone who violated her boundaries, and Ahmad didn't know she could say stop.
I have firsthand experience with not being a part of sex ed classes, and I know that that didn't protect me from anything.
And she says being kept out of sex ed made things harder for her in another way.
The same year I was sitting out of sex ed class, I actually developed feelings for a female friend of mine, a classmate of mine. And I didn't have any language to really, you know, to understand that it was normal and healthy. I just went right into kind of condemning myself and basically going with whatever homophobic jokes I'd heard from classmates.
And that's why Rosa Nazari thinks rolling back the curriculum might have serious repercussions. She's with 519, a Toronto city agency focused on LGBTQ communities. Nazari says gay and trans youth already have higher rates of depression and suicide, and now their sex ed curriculum might not even mention people like them.
That's homophobia and transphobia playing out, right? Because what we've done is we had a curriculum that included LGBTQ2S+ people.
2S+ is shorthand for two-spirit, an indigenous term used to describe people who are gay or trans.
And we've taken that away. That's sending a very clear message that we do not support LGBTQ2S peoples.
As kids start school this week, the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario is seeking an injunction so teachers can use the WIN curriculum. As things stand, teachers do still have some discretion in class, and some say they'll teach aspects of the WIN curriculum. The Ford government's set up a phone number people can call to report teachers who do that. It's not clear what the punishment would be. Rain Fisher-Kwan, the teenager who helped organize the first protest this summer, says the activism's been good for her, even if the WIN curriculum won't be taught this school year. After a video of a speech Fisher-Kwan gave was widely shared online, lots of people reached out with support, but she also got threatening hate mail.
So it was kind of like I saw like the best and worst of humanity. But I think that it's made me a lot more, like, resolute. Like, it's kind of shown me that I can actually have, like, an impact. And I feel like that's not something that 16-year-old girls feel a lot.
Fisher-Kwan says she'll keep talking about everything she thinks kids need to know about sex, even if her teachers can't. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Toronto.
Here's a preview of an interview you'll be hearing tomorrow on The World. It's with journalist and former Marine C.J. Shivers about Americans fighting overseas and the disconnect between U.S. military leaders and the enlisted men and women fighting our wars. Shivers talks about a U.S. fighter pilot in Kosovo. His job was to drop bombs.
And one of those bombs, he believes, may have hit a civilian home.
Shivers says the airman thought he might have killed innocent people and that he could have prevented their deaths.
He actually wanted to be reprimanded or to have what he thought was likely a mishap examined so that its causes would be understood. And that wasn't the attitude of his bosses. It was more like, we need to get back out and hit tomorrow's target list.
Why some of America's fighters think our military has lost its way. A provocative conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist C.J. Shivers right here tomorrow on the show. In the past 7 years, millions of people have been forced to flee Damascus and other cities in Syria. We know that story well. Less well known are the stories of Syrians who chose to stay. And here's one of those tales. Somar Hazim used to own a small boutique hotel in the old center of Damascus. Business was going well before the war, but in 2013, Somar was forced to shut down the hotel. Now, a few years later, he's opened one of the first bars to reemerge in the old city. Somar says nightlife in Damascus is back.
Everybody was coming to see who are those people who opened this place in the middle of the war. The situation got better. They were at the beginning like three or four places, and now there are like 30 places in the same street.
I'm Noor, I'm 21 years old, and every Tuesday I come here, and I love it so much. It's like a very cozy place, so I really enjoy here. People abroad think that we don't have bars in Syria, but people go to the bars and stay till 4 a.m. or 6 a.m. sometimes. We just like party and drink and laugh and have fun.
Most of the clients here, they prefer to drink whiskey or vodka. And we have some Syrian invented cocktails, such as this one that he is making now. The name is Blue Hawaii. It's a mixture of vodka and pineapple and some blue kamikaze liquor.
I mean, Damascus in general has this spirit. Everyone feels it. The nightlife has been booming for a while because when things get hard, people look for ways out sometimes. For a second, you can detach yourself from all the ugliness. Throughout the war, people have drawn closer to each other because they've realized that really we don't have anything else.
Being in a place which is near to the front lines between mortar shelling, you go to this place and you have a drink. I think that idea was really, really, really tempting for too many people. We gained our identity of nightlife in Damascus now. It's not exactly the same city it used to be before the war, but I think it's becoming another city. I'm a bit optimistic about the future, but I think we need time to just forget about what happened during the last 7 years.
Life during wartime. That's Damascus bar owner Somar Hazim speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. It was around this time a year ago that Hurricane Harvey pummeled Houston and other cities in Texas. The World's Monica Campbell reported on the hurricane's aftermath, where she met many people whose lives and livelihoods were devastated. Over the past year, she kept thinking about one of those families, and recently, Monica went back to Houston to see them again.
I met Sylvia and her family a year ago, just after Hurricane Harvey destroyed their apartment complex, flooding their home.
La gente saca y saca y saca muebles y saca y saca. Yo desde el...
We're just here, taking out, saving what we can, she said. It wasn't much, some shoes, a few chairs. Sylvia also worried about where her kids, two girls and two boys, would sleep that night. I asked her about the big convention center nearby. It was converted into a shelter. Her son Joshua, who's 13, stood by while we talked.
Have you been to where they're offering help?
No. No, we haven't got there. No, we haven't got there. We just stayed in these apartments.
And so what will you do?
No, no sé. No tengo idea. She doesn't know. She has no idea.
Sylvia didn't go to the city shelter. She's lived here 17 years, but she's undocumented from Guatemala. It's why we're only using her first name. She worried about the security presence at the shelter, the police patrolling, and that she'd get asked for her papers and risk deportation. Today, a year later, Sylvia and her family are recuperating.
Sylvia.
I went to their new apartment in the same neighborhood, just one complex over from their old place. The living room is pretty empty, except for a TV and a fan going full blast. It's sweltering over 100 today. The AC isn't working.
No tenemos furniture. Pero no, no, no problema. No necesito. Estoy bien. Estamos bien. Estoy bien esto.
No furniture. Well, you have some furniture. You, well, sí, you have tenemos, a dining room table.
Sí. Sí, tenemos la mesa de comer que me la regalaron.
Sylvia and her girls show me their kitchen table, donated, and a basket of toys, also donated. How many rooms?
Two.
Two rooms.
And two bedrooms.
You got a flute player here. And a keyboardist. There are two beds, The boys share one, Sylvia and the girls the other. It's been a slow recovery. The family didn't have insurance. They didn't try to access official aid. Sylvia says she didn't want to give the government any information. They relied on donations, the church, the dollar store nearby. And she's filling the living room with art in old frames, drawings of sunflowers, orchids, Yosemite.
Ese estaba tirado allá en el bote de la basura. Y dije yo, ay, tan bonito.
I see art tossed in the trash. People throw away beautiful things, she says. There's also one big difference with the new apartment. It's on the second floor.
Yeah, bastante diferencia porque estamos arriba.
Do you feel safer?
No sé porque que el tornado fue el que nos tiró allá. Porque si ve ahorita
then, están reparando. Sylvia tells me something else that I didn't know when we first met after Hurricane Harvey, that it wasn't the first time they'd lost their home here. It happened in 2015 when a tornado struck. It ripped through their apartment.
Aquí enfrente todo eso está cerrado, no hay vecinos.
She points outside to apartments with windows still boarded over. So here she is again, post-disaster. But this time, she's without her husband. He was deported before the hurricane. Joshua, who's a U.S. citizen, hopes to visit his dad next summer. He'll fly there alone. How long has it been since you've seen him?
I guess a few years. Years, actually.
But then someone new arrived from Guatemala, Sylvia's older son. He's 19. Sylvia says he fled gangs. This spring, he got his high school diploma here in Houston. When I visited, he was out working construction, contributing to what Sylvia makes cleaning houses to make the $700 rent. I ask Sylvia how surviving these disasters has changed her life.
Me ha cambiado mucho. Que hoy tenemos y mañana no sabemos.
A lot, she says. What we have today could be gone tomorrow. For now, she appreciates some stability and hopes it stays that way. For The World, Monica Campbell, Houston.
And that is The World for this Thursday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.